Chapter 3. A night bred in hell, thought Sam Harding, ticket agent for the New York and Quebec Northern Railroad, as he stood on the platform of his station and watched the poplar trees bordering the track lean horizontal under the battering gusts of a violent windstorm. He was experiencing the end of a heat wave that had baked the New England states. The hottest May since 1880, proclaimed Wackettshire's weekly newspaper in red-letter Bodoni typeface. Lightning hurtled through the pre-dawn sky in jagged patterns, accompanied by a 24-degree drop in temperature in 1 hour. Harding caught himself shivering at the sudden change as the breeze whipped at his cotton shirt, dampened by sweat from the oppressive humidity. Down on the river he could see lights from a string of barges as they nosed their way against the downstream current. One by one, their dim yellow glows blinked off and then on again as the barges passed under the foundation piers of the great bridge. Harding's station sat on the outer perimeter of the town, village really, where the tracks of the railroad bisected in a cross. The main trunk ran north to Albany, while the branch line swung east over the Deauville-Hudson River Bridge to Columbiaville before forking south to New York City. Though no drops had fallen, there was a definite smell of rain in the air. He walked over to his Model T Ford Depot hack, untied a number of small cords under the edge of the roof, and rolled down the leatherette side curtains over the oak side panels. Then he fixed them into place with the Murphy fasteners and re-entered the station. Hiram Meacham, the Western Union night man, was hunched over a chessboard, engaged in his favorite pastime of playing another telegrapher down the line. The panes in the windows rattled from the wind, keeping cadence with the staccato of the telegraph key screwed to the table in front of Meacham. Harding picked up a coffee pot from a kerosene stove and poured himself a cup. "Who's winning?" Meacham looked up. "I drew Standish down in Germantown. He's a damn tough customer." The key danced and Meacham moved one of the chess pieces. "Queen to knight four," he grunted. "You don't exactly look encouraging." Harding pulled a watch from a vest pocket and studied the dial, knitting his eyebrows thoughtfully. "The Manhattan Limited is 12 minutes late." "Probably behind schedule because of the storm," Meacham said. He tapped out his next move, placed his feet on the table, and leaned his chair back on two legs, awaiting his opponent's response. Every clapboard on the station's walls creaked as a firebolt scorched the sky and struck a tree in a nearby pasture. Harding sipped at the steaming coffee and unconsciously stared at the ceiling, wondering if the lightning rod atop the roof was in good order. A loud clang from the telephone bell above his roll-top desk broke his thoughts. "Your dispatcher with news on the Limited," Meacham predicted with unconcern. Harding bent the swinging arm of the telephone upward to his standing position and pressed the small circular receiver to his ear. "Wackettshire," he answered. The dispatcher's voice from Albany was barely discernible through the storm-induced static on the circuit. "The bridge. Can you see the bridge?" Harding turned toward the east window. His vision carried no further than the end of the platform in the darkness. "Can't see. Have to wait for the next lightning flash." "Is it still standing?" "Why wouldn't it be standing?" Harding replied irritably. "A tugboat captain just called from Catskill and raised hell," the dispatcher's voice crackled back. "Claims a girder dropped off the bridge and damaged one of his barges. Everyone here is in a panic. The agent in Columbiaville says the Limited is overdue." "Tell them to relax. She hasn't reached Wackettshire yet." "You sure?" Harding shook his head in disbelief at the dispatcher's simple-minded question. "Damn it, don't you think I'd know if a train passed my station?" "Thank heavens we're in time." The relief in the dispatcher's tone came over the line despite the interference. "The Limited has 90 passengers on board, not counting the crew, and a special government car carrying some big-shot official to Washington. Flag it down and inspect the bridge at first light." Harding acknowledged and hung up. He lifted a shuttered lantern with a red lens off a hook on the wall, shook it to see if the tank held kerosene, and lit the wick. Meacham peered over his chess pieces questioningly. "You flagging the Limited?" Harding nodded. "Albany says a girder fell off the bridge. They want it checked before a train crosses over. Want me to light the semaphore lantern for you?" A high-pitched whistle pierced the wind outside. Harding cocked an ear, measuring the sound. It came again, only slightly louder. No time. I'll flash it down with this. Suddenly the door opened, and a stranger stood on the threshold, his eyes ferreting the interior of the station. He was built like a jockey, rail-thin and short. A mustache was blonde, as was the hair that showed beneath the Panama straw hat cocked on his head. The clothes indicated a fastidious dresser. Weber and Heilbronner English-cut suit with silk stitching, the razor-creased pants stopping evenly above a pair of two-tone brown suede and leather shoes. His most eye-catching feature, however, was a Mauser automatic pistol held in a slim, effeminate hand. "What the hell's going on?" Meacham mumbled in awe. "A hold-up, gentlemen," the intruder said with the tiniest hint of a smile. "I thought it was obvious." "You're crazy," snapped Harding. "We've got nothing to rob." "Your station has a safe," said the stranger, nodding toward the steel box standing on high casters in one corner of Harding's office area. "And safes contain valuable commodities like payrolls, perhaps." "Mister, robbing a railroad is a federal offense. Besides, Wackature is a farming community. There's no payroll shipments. Hell, we don't even have a bank." "I'm in no mood to debate the economics of Wackature." The long hammer on the Mauser was pulled back. "Open the safe." The whistle tooted again, much closer this time, and Harding knew from experience the sound came only a quarter mile up the track. "Okay, whatever you say, right after I flagged the Limited." The gun went off, and Meacham's chessboard exploded, scattering the pieces about the linoleum floor. "No more stupid talk about stopping trains. I suggest you get on with it." Harding stared at the robber, his eyes stricken with sudden horror. "You don't understand. The bridge might be out." "I understand that you're trying to be clever." "I swear to God!" "He's telling the truth," Meacham cut in. "A warning just came over the line from Albany about the bridge." "Please listen to us," Harding pleaded. "You could be murdering 100 people." He paused, his face pale as the headlamp from the approaching engine beamed through the window. The whistle shrilled no more than 200 yards away. "For God's sake!" Meacham snatched the lantern from Harding's hand and lunged for the open doorway. The gun blasted again. A bullet thudded into his hip, and he crashed to the floor a foot short of the threshold. He rolled to a kneeling position and cocked his arm to throw the lantern onto the track outside. The man in the straw hat grabbed his wrist and in the same motion brought the pistol barrel down on Meacham's head and kicked the door shut. Then he whirled on Harding and snarled, "Open that damn safe!" Harding's stomach heaved at the sight of Meacham's blood spreading on the floor. And then he did as he was told. He clutched the combination dial, sick with helplessness as the train roared by on the track not 20 feet behind him, the lights from the Pullman coaches casting flickering reflections through the panes of the station windows. In less than a minute, the clack from the last car's wheels on the rails had died away, and the train was gone, heading up the grade to the bridge. The tumblers dropped into place, and Harding twisted the bolt arm, swung the heavy door open, and stepped aside. Inside were a few small, unclaimed packages, old station logbooks and records, and a cash box. The robber scooped up the box and counted out the contents. $18.14, he said indifferently. Hardly a munificent sum, but it should keep me eating for a few days. He neatly folded the bills in a leather breast wallet and dropped the change in a pants pocket. Casually tossing the emptied cash box on the desk, he stepped over Meacham and faded into the storm. Meacham moaned and stirred. Harding knelt and lifted the telegrapher's head. "The train?" Meacham murmured. "You're bleeding pretty bad," said Harding. He pulled a red bandana from his hip pocket and pressed it against the flowing wound. Clenching his teeth against the burning agony of two injuries, Meacham stared dully at Harding. "Call the East Bank. See if the train is safe." Harding eased his friend's head to the floor. He grabbed for the phone and threw back the extension arm, opening the transmitter circuit. He shouted into the mouthpiece, but silence was his only reply. He closed his eyes for a moment and prayed, then tried again. The line to the other side of the river was dead. Feverishly, he turned the selector wheel on the Cummings Ray sender and called the dispatcher at Albany. All he heard was static. "I can't get through." He could taste the bitterness in his mouth. "The storm has disrupted the circuits." The telegraph key began to click. "The telegraph lines are still open," muttered Meacham. "That's Standish with his chess move." Painfully, he dragged his body to the table and reached up and broke in the incoming message, tapping out an emergency line clearance. Then both men momentarily stared at each other, fearful of what they might learn in the morning light that was beginning to tint the eastern sky. The wind poured through the doorway and scattered loose papers and whipped at their hair. "I'll alert Albany," Meacham said finally. "You see to the bridge." As if in a dream, Harding jumped to the track bed, his panic mushrooming, and ran recklessly over the uneven rail ties. Soon his breath came in great gasps, and his heart felt like it was thumping out of his rib cage. He topped the grade and hurried under the girders of the West Bank's flanking span toward the center of the Deauville-Hudson Bridge. He tripped and sprawled, gashing a knee on a rail spike. He picked himself up and stumbled on. At the outer edge of the center span, he stopped. An icy nausea coursed through his body as he stood in numbed abhorrence and gazed through unbelieving eyes. There was a great empty gap in the middle of the bridge. The center truss had vanished into the cold, gray waters of the Hudson River 150 feet below. Vanished, too, was the passenger train carrying 100 men, women, and children. "Dead! All dead!" Harding cried in helpless rage. "All for $18.14.